Right, so in Eden Church we've got a verse for the year, which is a verse that it's something that Jesus said. He said, "I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." And to help us understand what life to the full looks like, then we've got a series where we're looking at a number of characters in the Bible and see what it's like to live life to the full. And I've got a slightly unusual one for you this morning, which you might not have expected. For those of you who know a little bit about Rahab, you might not have expected her for Mother's Day, but that's fine. We'll get on and you'll understand why I've chosen it. And but it's Mother's Day, so let's start off a little bit by talking about mothers. And Paul, writing to Timothy, says something about mothers. He says, "I'm reminded of your sincere faith, which first lived in your grandmother Lois, and in your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded, now lives in you also." And many of us can relate to that, can't we? We can relate to having a mother who brought us up in the faith. I can. A couple of you know my mum, and she's a woman of God. And she taught me to honour God and to live according to his word. But she was also, in turn, brought up in the same way by her mother. And my grandmother is dead now. She lived to over 100, and I can remember as she got older, then her when her eyesight failed and she couldn't read her Bible anymore, then she didn't sort of stop reading her Bible. She just got a bigger print Bible, and when her eyesight got a little bit worse, it just meant that she sat out in the conservatory where the light was a bit brighter, so she could still read her Bible. And thanks to my grandmother, I know loads of Welsh hymns, even though I don't speak Welsh, because she used to sing them all the time when she was washing up the dishes. So things like "Dyma gariad y felen moroedd" slip off the tongue pretty easily for me, even though I don't actually know what it means. And on the other side of the family as well, my dad was brought up by his mum, who was another great Christian woman who was known for her hospitality. She had a large house, and it seemed to me that whenever we visited, it was full of missionaries who she was putting up while they were spending time in the country. But in turn, her mother, who lived in Plymouth and was in Plymouth during the war, I've had at least half a dozen complete strangers over the years come up to me and say, "I know who you are because when I was in the services in the war and I was stationed in Plymouth and I was away from home and I was frightened, your grandmother looked after me." And so I've got a great tradition in my family of Christian women who've brought up the next generation. But that kind of begs a bit of a question, doesn't it? The question is this: do you need a Christian mum like I've got to be a full member of the church? And that's quite an important question, because not all of us may be, you know, it may be in the same position to be. So, you know, am I out here this morning to teach you because I've got the right stock? You know, my great-grandmother was a Plymouth Brethren, you know, right? Or is it something else? And that's a good question. And to answer the question, and you might think you might know, that you know the answer, but we're going to explore it and see what we can find. And to get there, we're going to go back to ancient Jericho, back to the Bronze Age. And this is the late Bronze Age, for those of you who are historians. We're probably talking about 1500 BC or thereabouts. And Jericho was a city that was close to the River Jordan, not quite on the banks of the River Jordan, but very close to it, on a plain which is largely desert, but just around the city then there's a powerful spring, which meant there was plenty of water for the fields to be irrigated around it. It's close to the Dead Sea, and it's in the modern day territory, the occupied territory of the West Bank. So it's in territory occupied by Israel, and it's probably the lowest point on earth, at about 600 feet below sea level. But that's kind of where it is. But you know, at the time of our story, in the late Bronze Age, then Jericho had already been a city for thousands of years, and it was a sophisticated civilization. The Canaanite people had it. It was linked to the great empires of the time, so they had powerful trading links with Egypt to the south and with Babylon across the desert to the east, and the Hittites in Turkey, modern day Turkey, in the north, and the emerging civilization of the Greeks across the sea. And it was a rich community. Jericho was a rich city. It was walled for protection, And they made a living exporting bitumen and salt, which were scarce commodities in the outside world. So a rich community, well connected. And life was surprisingly normal, right? You know, I mean, this is 3,500 years ago, but you might kind of like sort of picture this as sort of like peasants running around who can barely talk and a little more than apes. No, I mean, this was the kind of place where you'd probably sort of feel at home pretty soon. You know, if you went to the city, you'd probably sort of find that there would be smiths working in their smithies, and they'd be making everything from hairpins through to kitchen knives. There would be market traders who'd be selling exotic goods brought in by camel from Egypt or from Babylon. And every morning when the city gates opened after they'd been shut for protection overnight, then a stream of farmers would go out and work in their fields, and they'd bring back barley and wheat, which meant they could eat bread and beer. I mean, hey, what a great place there, bread and beer. What more could you want? Olives and leeks and garlics and grapes. And life was normal. Kids played in the street, and they ignored their parents like they do today. Little girls bullied their little brothers. And kids grew up, and they married, and they fell in love, and they had kids. And, you know, and life was just a normal place. But it was a bit different. There weren't any churches, obviously, this long ago. And they worshipped a goddess, Asherah. And Asherah was a goddess of fertility. And it's a family service, so I won't explain how you might worship a goddess of fertility, but I'm sure your imagination can help you to get there. And they worshipped Moloch as well. And one of the things that Moloch required was a steady stream of child sacrifices. So children were often sacrificed. But that was Jericho, ancient Jericho. And just across the river from this city, suddenly appeared a huge horde of nomadic people. The Israelites had been crossing the Sinai Desert for decades, and they camped just across on the other side of the Jordan River. And the people of Jericho were pretty scared because they weren't quite sure what was going on, but they could guess. So, we've got a reading, haven't we?
Then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies. "Go look over the land," he said, "especially Jericho." So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there. The king of Jericho was told, "Look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy out the land." So the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab: "Bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they have come out to spy the whole land." But the woman who had taken the two men and hidden them, she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they come from." At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, the men left. "I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You may catch up with them." But she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax she had laid out on the roof. So the men set out in pursuit of the spies on the road that leads to the fords of the Jordan. And as soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut.
Right, so there in Jericho, you've got a lady called Rahab, who was an innkeeper, the name means broad, and the interpretation of the name is exactly as you might guess it would be, given her occupation. And in this inn that she kept, for want of a better term, then two strangers turned up, who had been sent there from the camp of the Israelites across the other side of the River Jordan. And there was probably a great place for the strangers to hide. You know, there would have been a steady stream of men going in and out of Rahab's house. And they wouldn't have attracted any attention. But clearly, when they got there, they started talking to her, and they told her all about the God who they worshipped and the God who they believed was directing them and telling them how they should live. And while the men are there staying in Rahab's inn, then there's a degree of suspicion arises that somebody has spotted them and thinks that maybe these strangers are not visiting Rahab's premises for the usual purposes, but are actually spies. And so the king sends out a couple of people. And Rahab gets to hear about it just in time as the soldiers are turning up. And she tells the men to go upstairs and hide on the roof. Now, she was drying flax on the roof. And I don't know if you have any linen clothes or any sort of linen curtains or something like that at home. But linen is made from flax. And the process is like this. You grow the flax and then you harvest the flax and you dump it in a pond. And you leave it there for several weeks. Ideally in stagnant water, so bacteria and mold and fungus and all that kind of stuff can grow and rot down all of the softer parts of the fabric, and then you're left with just the fibres. And the idea is you dry out the flax at just the right point where the soft parts have rotted, but not the fibres. So basically, she's got a stinking great compost heap up on top of her roof, and she tells the men to hide under it. It's a great place because, you know, really not many people are going to want to go and play with a pile of stinking stinking flax drying in the sun. So the soldiers demand to see the men. And they say, where are they? Now, what do you do at this point? This is a great dilemma, isn't it? Right? Because if she says, oh, they're hiding up on the roof, then the men are going to get killed. If she doesn't say anything at all, then she's going to get taken away and tortured until she does give an answer. And if she says they're not here, then she's telling a lie. And as we'll discover shortly, she's just like learned to trust this God that the men believe in, and this God is a God of integrity who doesn't believe in lying. So she tells the lie, and we'll come back to that in a moment. And she says, they went that way, right? And so the soldiers, they have a quick look around. They leave the rotting pile of flax up on the roof. They don't look at it. It's a bit smelly. And they think there's no one there. And they go outside the city and go chasing after them to try and find them. And then later in the story, after the bit that Carla read to us, then we find that after the city gates were shut, she lowers a rope out of her window and they climb down the rope. And they hide in the hills for a few days and return to Joshua. And what happens next? Well, I've been assured by one of my kids that I should not show you this video because it'll have you cringing in your seats. But I actually think it's quite good. So I'll let you make your own decisions. And this tells you exactly what happened next.
Delta Written Voice.
You may talk about the man of Gideon, you may talk about old King Saul, but there's none like good old Joshua at the Battle of Jericho. Up to the walls of Jericho, he marches spear in hand. Go blow them ram horn, Joshua, God, on the battle left in my hand. Oh, the lamb ram, horns begin to blow, the trumpets begin to sound. Oh, Joshua commanded the people to shout, walls come tumbling down. That morning, Joshua, at the Battle of Jericho.
Jericho, Jericho, the battle of Jericho.
I tell you, Josh, it's the battle of
Jericho.
Keep telling you, Josh, it's the battle of Jericho. Jericho, oh, Jericho. Josh, it's the battle of Jericho.
When the walls come tumbling. Walls come tumbling, walls come tumbling, walls come tumbling.
And the walls come a tumbling. Down.
Brilliant, isn't it? Right? That's That is not cringing. That is absolutely superb. Marvellous. I know you're going to go home and watch it. It's on YouTube, Delta Rhythm Boys. Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down, right? So I'm sure that most of you are familiar with the story, but Rahab had made an agreement with the Israelites as a result of her saving the spies, that she would hang the cord, the same red cord, presumably made of linen, that the spies had crawled out of her window on, that she would leave that hanging in the window, and the Israelite army would leave her and her family safe. And so they did. And that's the end of the story, right? You don't hear any more about Rahab in the Old Testament. There's another Rahab who's mentioned a couple of times in the Minor Prophets, but it's a different Rahab. Probably not a real person. And, you know, that sort of like feels like just a kind of, you know, an interesting, a fun story, but there's actually quite a lot that we can learn from it. And let's start, right, by going back to this question of what Rahab did when she was asked where the spies were. Now, if you're old enough to remember Republica, I think they were it was the 1990s that they were around as a band. Then they sang a song which said this: I know my ex-boyfriend lies. Oh, he does it all the time. It's just his permanent disguise. Yeah. But he's drop-dead gorgeous. And when I look at you, you're forgiven. So there you go, right? According to Republica, it's okay to lie as long as you've got sex appeal, which is a bit shallow, I suppose. But, you know, Rahab had sex appeal, so maybe it was okay. Does that excuse her lies? Does anything, right? Does anything excuse lying? And it's a bit of a theological debate. There was this one sort of American professor who said this: few subjects ignite my seminary classes like this one. So ideas about whether Rahab did the right thing when she told a porcupine, excite theologians. Augustine, writing in the 4th century, said that it was never morally permissible to lie. But Bonhoeffer, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the pastor, the Lutheran pastor from the 1940s, who he examined this in some depth, and he said, look, truth sometimes conflicts with other moral obligations. And he lied through his teeth to protect innocent people from Nazi soldiers and ended up being hanged with piano wire for what he did. Now, a lot of evangelical scholars line up with Augustine. Others will line up with Bonhoeffer. And I'm not going to tell you what you should think about this. Some people say that Rahab should have told the truth and entrusted the outcome to God. But Rahab had competing moral imperatives. Even if she told the truth to the soldiers, she still wouldn't be doing another thing that God says, which is to have respect for authority. And she would have been undermining the government of the land that she came from. And she had a duty of hospitality as well, which is a conflicting thing. And I think that for me, James settles the question when he says this. Was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction? But also it says in Hebrews, and I don't have this verse up there, that by faith the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. Now, most of us may never find ourselves in a situation like Dietrich Bonhoeffer found himself in, or Rahab found himself in. But very, very rarely, it might be the right thing to do to be dishonest. But that's not really what I want to think about. There's something really remarkable going on here. What you've got is a woman, Rahab, who is a pagan Canaanite worshipper of Asherah, who's got a lifestyle choice that can best be described as questionable, who's a brand new believer in God, and she cuts through the theological debate, and rather than arguing with other people in seminary, she acts in faith and does the right thing. And I think that's remarkable, that someone so young in the faith can make such a mature decision. And we'll come back to that. But there is one more mention of Rahab in the Bible. And interestingly, you know the Delta Rhythm Boys, they sang, You may talk about your men of Gideon, you may talk about your men of Saul, but there's none like good old Joshua at the Battle of Jericho. Well, actually, forget good old Joshua at the Battle of Jericho and think of good old Rahab in the Battle of Jericho, because in the New Testament, Rahab is mentioned more times than Joshua. So that's one in the eye for Joshua. But anyway, that's besides. We've got a couple more verses to read. Now, don't you hate it when you're kind of reading your Bible and you suddenly stumble across a list of names, you know, the genealogies? But sometimes the genealogies just unpick some really fascinating things for us. And the New Testament opens with the verse that you're about to read now. And it says, this is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. So Jesus' ancestors. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac the father of Jacob. Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah the father of Perez and Zerah, whose name was Tamar. Perez the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Aminadab. Aminadab the father of Nashon. Nashon the father of Salmon. And don't fall asleep. And Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Extraordinary. We heard about Boaz. Was it last week or 2 weeks ago? 2 weeks ago. We heard about Boaz 2 weeks ago. He was the one who married Ruth. An incredible guy who showed, you know, who showed great spiritual maturity in the way that he behaved. And he was the son of Rahab, this Canaanite prostitute. And it's interesting because there are only four women who were mentioned in Jesus' genealogy. And, you know, there could be lots of women named. There's kind of great characters in the Old Testament who are women who aren't mentioned in his genealogy, who were in his lineage. Why were these ones singled out? Well, some people have suggested that the four of them who were mentioned were Gentiles. And Rahab was one of those. So Jesus wasn't a pure blood Jew. He had Gentile blood in him. And who was this Salmon that she married? Well, again, you can go crawling through lists of genealogies that you'll find in the Old Testament. And one of them tells you that his father led the tribe of Judah. So he was probably the most eligible bachelor in the land of Israel at the time. So this prostitute found that she had married the biggest catch as a guy out of all of the Israelites. Extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. Why would he choose to marry her with her questionable past? And, you know, some people don't like the idea that Rahab is sitting in Jesus' genealogy and in David's genealogy, and they try and deny it's the same woman, but it's evident, it's clear that this is the woman that we just read about in Jericho. And God's trying to teach us something here. But what's he trying to teach us? Well, my opening Mother's Day question was this, was do you need a Christian mum to be a full member of the church? And Paul asked that question as well. And he asked it, and he answered with a very loud no, you don't. And Rahab tells us that very dodgy characters can be and should be fully accepted in the church. What does that mean for us? There are two lessons, but we're going to have another short musical interlude. And I think, Mark, that I first encountered this music about 30 years ago in your flat when you were a student, when somebody else put it on. So you may or may not recognise it. Can we have the music, please? I apologise for that. That sermon is absolutely marvellous. Portsmouth Sinfonia, if you want to look them up. And the idea of the Portsmouth Sinfonia was that, that you were allowed to be a musician to play in the Portsmouth Sinfonia, but you weren't allowed to play your own instrument, or you were allowed to be someone who wasn't a musician. And you kind of got this, they were trying to be a bit avant-garde and create a sound cloud that sort of resembled the original music. Great, whatever. But here's the point, right? I worry that sometimes when we who are established Christians, who've got mums and dads who brought us up in the church, and it goes back for generations, I worry that sometimes when we encounter new Christians, that they sound to us the way that the Portsmouth Sinfonia sounds when we're expecting to hear proper musicians. And I worry that, you know, we kind of look at people and think, well, they're not like us. Maybe they don't come to church quite as often as we do, or they say some things that we wouldn't say, or they don't use the right language. And I worry that people who don't have, sort of, you know, people who've got mums like Rahab rather than mums like my mum, sort of could get pushed to the periphery of the church. And I'm not saying it's like that, but I'm saying it's something that could so easily happen. And do you ever worry that, I'm not saying these things happen, but do you ever worry that Christians from established families have an unspoken higher status in the church? Do you ever worry that Christians with the right upbringing are more likely to be trusted with responsibility in a church? Do you ever worry that we might find that Christians with whom we grew up are closer to the church's inner social circles? Do you worry that children from Christian families might be treated differently in our youth work? Do you worry that spiritual wisdom from new believers might be afforded less respect than spiritual wisdom from established Christians? Do you ever worry that we might assume that people with the right history are better placed to pray for us, or better placed to heal us, or better place to teach us? Do you ever worry that we might be more sensitive to the wants and needs of established Christians than to those of new converts? Do you ever worry that we might unconsciously regard ourselves as better Christians because of our upbringing? Do you ever worry, in short, that we might be becoming a hereditary church? And Rahab's story teaches us that these things should not be so. Right, we keep talking about disciples who make disciples. Here's the card, here, isn't it? If you haven't got one, pick one up from the back. And we've asked two questions about it. Who are you discipling, and who's discipling you? And if you're a new believer, you might have assumed that you have no one to disciple because you're the new believer, and what have you got to teach? Well, Rahab had spiritual discernment that was more effortless than students in the theological college. And if you're an established believer, you might have assumed that you need to find a young Christian as a project. But maybe, just maybe, we need to turn that on its head. And Rahab shows how a new believer can have great discernment. Rahab shows how a convert can be embedded in the culture. And Rahab teaches us that new and returning believers can have experiences and wisdom from situations that established Christians just never encounter. And God doesn't limit his grace to those who are long in the spiritual tough. And passion and godly fire and the presence of God are not strongly correlated with age in the faith. And when you're thinking about your discipling relationships, maybe think about turning things on your head and ask yourself, what can I learn from the people who are new in the church? How can they disciple me? And I'll leave you with a final thought from the Apostle Paul, who says this. He's talking about having confidence in your upbringing. And he says this: I myself have reasons for such confidence. If anyone else thinks they've got reason to put confidence in the flesh, I have more. I was circumcised on the eighth day. I was of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, with regard to the law, a Pharisee, as for zeal, persecuting for the church, as for righteousness based on the law, faultless. I've got it all, he says. And then he says, but whatever were gains to me, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. Don't put confidence in what we are. Put confidence in God.